the seat before you out of order. I do appreciate it. Members of the commission and Madam Chair, have with me tonight Mansco Perry, who is the investment advisor, not emeritus yet, but in charge of the State Board of Investment. We are here to request a consideration of an investment portfolio expansion. But I use expansion carefully because it isn't what you might normally think. Just as in football, in modern portfolio theory or under investment policy for pensions or other portfolios of securities, we not only have to think about playing good offense, but we also need to make sure that we are able to play good defense. And having the right tools in the toolbox for either opportunity, I think, is most beneficial, particularly when you're looking after the assets of the state, their pensioners, and the people that subscribe to that for their well-being as they look at retirement. Madam Chair, with your approval, I will move to introduce my testifier and allow him to explain the bill.
Mr. Perry, welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mansco Perry. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer of the State Board of Investment. The proposal that we have this evening is a change, a technical change in our statute 11A. It's 11A24. And what we're asking for is to make essentially three changes to what we're authorized to invest in for the State Board of Investment. The first change is to allow us to do co-investments within our private market portfolio. The second is to excuse liquid alternatives, which we currently do, and they're usually in a limited partnership form, to excuse them from the 35% limitation that we have on investing in private market vehicles in the statute. And the last request is to allow us to do bank loans. The first item, co-investments. Well, co-investments are something we would use with our private market vehicles, primarily private equity. Currently, we're able to invest in private equity funds. These are private companies that are not held on exchange, but are put into a limited partnership by a general partner, and we generally participate as limited partners, meaning that we have no general liability in these. Our statute currently limits us from being more than 20% participant in these vehicles, and there have to be at least four other limited partners in the vehicle with us. What we're asking for by doing co-investments is the ability to, an example would be we would invest in the fund, and outside of the fund, the general partner would have another vehicle that we would invest in called the co-investment. Co-investments are items that have been around for quite some time. A lot of our sister pension investment organizations are able to invest in these. But the key thing in this regard is that this would enable us to invest at essentially lower expenses and receive a higher portion at the end of the investment than we normally would if we were only investing in the private market vehicle. So in the private market vehicle, we pay expenses generally on the order of 2% annually, and at the end of the investment, there's an 80-20 split. The LPs, ourselves, would get 80% of the investments, and the general partner would get 20%. By using these co-investment vehicles, the general partner doesn't charge a management fee and doesn't participate in any of the profit sharing that will go along in that vehicle. Essentially, what's taking place here is that we're simply just trying to augment the investment so that we can lower our fees. And these things have been around for, used by pension funds for about the last two decades. We haven't used them primarily because we don't believe that the statute allows us because of the constraints. And so we think that this is something that would be very good for the fund. I've had examples showing that by utilizing these that we can reduce our expenses by 10 or 25% by participating in an investment this way. So we think that this is something very good for the fund, and we'd ask you to entertain that. The second item that we're asking for is the ability to take our liquid alternative investments. These are investments that primarily because of the vehicle still would go against our 35% limitation. Generally, we would have stocks or bonds in a limited partnership, and because of it being in the limited partnership, they would go against the 35% limitation that we have. The last item are bank loans. Bank loans are very similar to bonds. They are indebtedness by corporations, but instead of issuing a bond to essentially get a loan, they would go to a bank, get a loan. Banks then take the loans and they would group them together, and what would happen in those cases is that our bond managers would then be able to buy the bonds. In many ways, they're less risky than some of the bonds that we invest in because they're higher in what's called a capital structure. So before an owner of a company would receive his share of the profits, the bond would have to be paid off, and they're usually pretty senior in the capital structure in this case. These are very similar to the bonds that our bond managers buy, but because they are issued by the banks rather than a corporation, they're slightly different but kind of the same nature. Currently, our statute doesn't allow us to invest in these instruments. We believe that they're in many cases as safe as bonds, in some cases safer, but we believe that the risk level of these are on par with what we're doing now. We just think that they provide us a better opportunity for greater diversification in the portfolio.
Thank you very much. Representative Albright, how did you arrive at these changes and not some others?
Madam Chair, I will defer answering that question to my testifier.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair and members, these are some changes we've been looking at for a while. We don't have any others that we're asking for. As your staff may have heard a couple of weeks ago, we did have a educational session for my board where it was pointed out that something called legal list, which unfortunately our 11A24 of our statute essentially is a legal list. Those items are really no longer best practices, but at this time we're not asking for a major change. We think that this is something that we need to do, and we would wait to make any other changes for a later day.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'll move the bill to be included in the omnibus pension bill.
Representative Vogel moves adoption of House File 3272 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 omnibus pension bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, actually, I had the pleasure of talking to Mr. Perry in my office on this little bit in the weeds, and I'm not against doing this, but you know, I don't want to be labeled as Mr. Stress Testing, but I guess I am, because when we talked about this, my concern becomes that we haven't really looked at the scenarios that we're facing relative to risk. And this does allow a little more latitude as far as investments in that other portion. And the way I would relate this to you is that the liability, where we're getting the money from, varies with different entities. And if you take a bank, it's depositor money, and banks can only invest in government securities and so forth. Then you make a couple of steps and you get the pensions, and they also have to be very secure. And then you start stepping down to people that are willing to take a lot of risk, and maybe their hedge funds or whatever, and their investments can be entirely different. And my concern is that what we're doing here is we're saying we're going to get 7.5%, and I know we have to search for that yield, and that's why I'm okay with this, because I think you have to use modern vehicles. But I'm not so sure that 7.5% is sustainable in the long run relative to the risk that we can do for a pension. And what the stress testing or sensitivity analysis does is it looks at it and says, what is the probability that you're going to hit this bogey, this number, this return? And this is the risk. And it might come back and say, well, you know, you have to be in the upper 80 or 90th percentile of evaluating risk properly to have this work out. And we might decide that, you know what, we can't do that at the time, and that might affect future investment decisions. So as we move through this, I really think that we have to look at how much risk are we willing to take as a pension commission relative to the return we're going to get, because right now that 10-year treasury is hovering right about 1.1%, 1.2%, and we're looking at getting 7.5. There's risk there. We don't know what it is. Just like the black swan event that just happened with the coronavirus, we don't know what's coming up, and that's why when we do this, I'm not against doing it, because I trust the State Board of Investment and Mr. Perry to be taking good care of our money, but they are searching for that 7.5%, and I think we should know whether or not it's possible to keep doing that on a long-term basis without putting future generations in risk of having some defaults or some credit issues that come up, and all of a sudden we don't have the money that we're investing back, much less the return. Thank you.
Now you have me scared. Mr. Perry, do you want to answer that?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, members, we take into great consideration when we invest not only the rate of return, but if you notice, the first word in the phrase is risk and return. We believe that we've taken appropriate risk in our portfolios. I've been associated with the organization since 1990. We always take risks into consideration. That's why we have a very diversified portfolio. These instruments, I've argued in the past that to a large extent they are less risky than what we see in the stock market every day. But in both cases, what we're doing with these investments are owning companies for the most part, and we take great care to try to ensure that what we're investing in, not only do we know what it is, we do our due diligence on the managers and their experience. And our experience has been quite good in these type of investments. So the co-investments will, in effect, allow us to in some ways lessen the risk that we take in some of our private equity partnerships that we get in. I understand the concerns that Representative Vogel has, and know, when we do our asset allocation and our asset liability studies, which we do on every 5 or 6 years, there is a form of risk stressing that takes place during this, and that's how we come up with our asset allocation.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? If not, Representative Vogel renews his motion to adopt 3272 and incorporate. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Go on your way, Representative Albright.
Merrily I go, Madam Chair.
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll revert to number one on the agenda, which is the approval of December 18th meeting minutes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move.
Thank you. Representative Rosen moves adoption of the minutes as printed. Is there any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Number two on the agenda is the introduction of our actuarial work plan from our new actuary. This is a big test now. This is your first time before the commission as a whole. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the commission. Our firm is Northern Consulting Actuaries, Inc., doing business as Van Eywarden Associates, and we are honored to begin serving the commission at this meeting. My name is Jim Van Eywarden. I'm the founder of the firm, started with the firm in 1991, started in the business in 1979. To my far right is my business partner, Mark Schulte. He started with the firm in 2009, and he's been in the business since 2001. And just next to me is my colleague, Emily Knutson, who started in the business in 2001, and she joined us straight out of the University of Minnesota. All of us are fellows of the Society of Actuaries, and that means we are approved actuaries according to Minnesota law and authorized to work on funding of the statewide pension plans. Each of us has a different focus in this process. My focus is on the big picture and making sure that members of the commission understand what all of our reports mean, what the reports from the plans and their retained actuaries mean. Just making sure you understand, that's my focus. Mark's focus is technical and on actuarial standards and making sure that our work and the work of the plans and their actuaries meets actuarial standards. Emily's focus is on the process and making sure that all the work that we need to do for the commission gets done correctly and on time. And I would like to hand it off to Emily to talk through just that, that is our work plan for this year.
Ms. Knutson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the four items we have on our work plan will all be completed by April 20th during the session. The first one, we will review the experience studies. We'll do that for three of the statewide plans, the MSRS, General, or SURF, Parageneral, and TRA. We will put together a formal report approving the proposed assumptions. This is a top priority. We want the actuaries to be able to use these assumptions in the July 1, 2020 valuations. We'll give some preliminary approval today and then follow that up with a formal report. After that, we'll review the LCPR standards for actuarial work. This really goes hand in hand with the experience studies. So we've done a preliminary review of those, and again, we'll issue a formal report. We will replicate the July 1, 2019 TRA actuarial valuation. We've received all the census information and other information we need to do that, and we have gotten started on the initial programming. The final thing we will do by April 20th is we will review July 1, 2019 actuarial valuation reports. In addition to the three that I've named earlier, the MSRS General, Parageneral, and TRA, we will also do this for the St. Paul teachers. We, again, have received all the reports from the commission and have gotten started on that process.
Thank you. What's next?
Next, I think, is moving on to item number three.
Unless there are questions for us. Members of the commission?
Seeing none. We must have passed. We have the plan before us. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we need approval on these, on the work plan before us? No.
Apparently not. Please, Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Murphy and Senator Rosen. This is all in our contract, so this resembles really closely what we have done historically for the plans and the review. So we are just carrying on with what we've done in the past, and this is all baked into the contract, so they've reviewed that and have had comments, and so we've all reached agreement on what needs to be done and by when.
So we will proceed to folder number three, in which we have two motions that have to be made. Ms. Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're looking at motion LCPR 20-M1. That is a motion to be approved by the commission to waive the requirement that the plans do 30-year projections. These are done every other year, and we had kind of rescheduled things and had them done actually last year for the plans. So this is just a year out, and I've set forth in the note here the reasons why we think this might be a good idea to move them out a year. We still have the one from last year. We also have not had a lot happen with the plans or with their assumptions in the intervening year. And then finally, the one-year delay would allow us to review the projections with the new assumptions worked into that report. So the thought was that this would be a good recommendation to bring to the commission and have the valuation projections done in a year. Mark Schulte's here also to talk about whether this is a good idea from the point of view of the commission's actuary.
Representative or Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, do you need a motion on that, or would you like to hear from Mr.
Schulte? Mr.
Schulte? Madam Chair, thank you. As Ms. Lincheski said, I discussed with her delaying these 1 year and agree with the recommendation that they be delayed 1 year, mostly because it will allow time to implement the new assumptions. Under more recent circumstances, too, maybe we'll have a little bit better feel for how current economic conditions might stabilize or affect the projections over the next few months once the next valuation is completed as a basis for projections next year.
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'll move the approval of the motion LCPR 20-M1.
Okay. Is there any additional comments, questions? If not, Representative Nelson renews his motion of adoption of CPR 20M1. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted and will be incorporated. Ms. Lincheski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to LCPR 20-M2, another motion for the approval by the commission. The plans, the three big plans, TRA, MSRS, general plan, and para-general plan, have all done their four-year experience studies. Those were completed in the fall and sent to us. They are on file and available for review on our website. The experience study reviews the actual experience of the plan against the assumptions, and it's a good opportunity then to tweak assumptions where we find that the experience is different. This is something that we did 4 years ago when the plans completed that experience study, and the plans have come back with their recommendations for changes to their assumptions. In your materials is the motion, and attached to the motion are the letters from each of the funds from the directors of MSRS, PARA, and TRA, requesting the commission to review their assumptions that are set forth in the information, and then approve those new assumptions. This is required by the statute, so in order to allow the plans to use the new assumptions with their next valuation, we need to approve them. If we don't approve them, they can take effect in a year. I believe historically we have always approved them upon request so that the plans can move forward with using the new assumptions.
Mr. Iwarden.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, thank you. We do recommend approval of the actuarial assumptions as proposed by each of the three main plans and their actuaries. And there are a number of reasons for that. As you look through the letters from the plans and the reports from the actuaries, it's easy to get lost in the details, but I'd like to offer just two main thoughts. Number one, the actuarial assumptions that the actuaries are making are quite good already. Number two, these changes are really just a matter of fine tuning. And the way we can tell that is by comparing the actual liabilities of each of the plans over the last 5 years with what was expected, that is, what the actuaries and the plans expected to happen. And in every case, for each of the three main plans over the last 5 years, there were big swings in investments. The investments are always quite, well, almost always quite different from what's expected, and you can see big swings in the unfunded liabilities. However, in the overall liabilities, we can compare the expected liabilities versus the actual liabilities. And in every case over the last 5 years, for each of the three plans, the actual liabilities were within 1% of what was expected. So they're quite good already, and from now it's just a matter of fine-tuning. And we have taken a preliminary look at all the details and would recommend approval.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the approval of motion LCPR 20-M2.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted and will be incorporated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You passed. Okay, we're going on to number five on the agenda. Okay. Presentation by the State Board of Investment. Mr. Perry.
Good evening, Chairman Murphy and members. My name is Ansco Perry, the Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at the State Board of Investment. I'll be very brief this evening. First item that I was requested to speak about were the returns for the combined pension assets of the State Board of Investment. I think it's been reported that our fiscal year returns for the last year were in the order of 7.3%, but that's some while ago. Recently, we did release our returns for calendar year 2019. I'm happy to report that for the calendar year, we did have a return of 20.1%, which was slightly above our benchmark of 20% for the year. Domestic equities were pretty robust last year, and we were able to take advantage of those, as well as our ability to continue to be somewhat profitable in all our alternative investments. One of the happy but surprising aspects of our portfolio is that while treasury rates were on the order, treasury yields were on the order of 2%, we were able to have a very good year with our treasury portfolio returning 10.5% for the year. Personally, pretty happy with the efforts of my staff as when you do a comparison of our performance versus many of our peers, we ranked in the first percentile for the calendar year. So feel pretty happy about that. More recently, through last week, it's been a slightly more challenging environment. As you all saw last week, we had five consecutive down days and somewhat disheartening. But while do have performance for the calendar year to date as of last Friday, we fortunately were only down 4.38% for the 2 months, and primarily that's a reflection of the equity markets, which for us were down about 9% through last Friday, but we were able to mitigate that with our treasury portfolio, which is much, much larger, smaller, being up 9% during that time period. So we feel as though the diversity that we have in the portfolio has done what it's been designed to do. It's mitigated some of the downfall we had. Today was another down day in the market. Kind of, last time I looked, kind of a 1,300 point spread between the high and low during the day. But given the Fed's 50 basis point cut in treasures again, we are pretty comfortable that we've mitigated that as well. So I think every time I come here, I point out that we can't forecast how the markets will be, but repeatedly I've said that they'll be volatile, and as we've seen the last week, they continue to be volatile, and I would expect, given what's going on around the world, particularly with what caused the recent downturn, the coronavirus, what's going on geopolitically with trade and so forth, that it will continue to be a volatile year. But while I can't say that the portfolio is completely resilient, we do believe that we're mindful of the risk that we're taking, and our efforts has shown that, well, I'll say that we have been lucky, that our efforts has shown that we are being rewarded appropriately for the things that we've done over the years. Are there any questions anyone has regarding our returns?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, thank you for being here. Very enlightening. Sometimes you can read my mind. I was going to ask you, how did the 14.5% S&P decline in the last 10 trading days affect the portfolio? And it's nice to hear that it's not that it's down, but it's not down as much as the other. This is more just to ask Mr. Perry to provide clarification for the committee and others who are assembled here for the benefit. Earlier in testimony, Representative Vogel talked about the 10-year treasury being at about a 1.1 yield. And you're talking about treasuries returning last year 10% plus, and then the treasuries this year being at 9% plus. Maybe you want to just background a little bit the difference between yield and premium because of the bond yields that you have on those and the appreciation that may occur on the asset that we hold in the way of those treasuries, and that thus accounting for the return that we're looking at that you quoted earlier.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the way bonds work is that there are two pieces to it. There's the interest rate that you get in the form of a coupon off the bond, but as interest rates move up or down, that has an impact on what the appreciation or depreciation of the value of the bond is. So while we have been at historical lows, small movements down in rates have a disproportionate increase in the value of the rates. We are concerned because for the last 10 years, many of us have believed that bonds that were that we thought were historically low after the Great Recession, being down at levels of one to three over the treasury curve, we have been concerned that rates would go up. It seems as though they have been able to continue to stay low and go down, but going from 1.5 to one, it would be like a bond being at six going down to three. I mean, it's the percentage movement in the rate that has the impact on the appreciation you get the bond. It's something we call duration, but I don't want to get into the weeds on some of this stuff. I still remain somewhat concerned that bond rates will go up, which is both good and bad, but if bond rates go up, then our bonds will, value of the bonds will go down even though we get a higher premium. But what's more alarming these days is something that some of us are still trying to get our heads around. We always kind of thought that the low end of bonds would be zero. Well, as we've seen over the last 10 years, not in the U.S., but around the world, that there's a perversity in the way these could work. Bonds can have negative yields. So in other words, I'm a bank and you deposit your money with me, and rather than me giving you interest, I'll charge you for letting me keep your money. Some of the reasons for that is a belief that if there are negative yields that investors will invest in more, I don't like using the word risk, but more risky assets, primarily equities and the like, and that consumers, rather than saving their money, will spend more. These are things that are done to stimulate the economy. The concern that some of us have is that this will be a new world for us if we if the Fed goes that route. There's been a lot of discussion that the Fed probably will not take this course, but it has happened around the world. So I'd say that is a risk that we're aware of. And again, one of the perversities of it is that if our bond portfolio go negative, the value of the bonds would go up. But I still don't think that's an adventure that we're hoping that's an adventure that we escape.
Do we get a warning?
I'm not going there.
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, Director Perry. When you mentioned your peers that you compare yourself to, who are those other states with about the same size portfolio, or who are your peers that you're comparing?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we are currently the, I believe, the 17th largest pension plan by assets in the country. We compare ourselves generally to the grouping in the top 25 that our pension assets are in the order of $70-75 billion. But we compare ourselves to those that are larger than us and those that are kind of a little smaller than us. Most of the ones you'll hear will be CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, CalPERS, the CalSTRS, which is the California State Teachers Retirement System. They're huge. CalPERS is about 400. I think CalSTRS is approach 300. The organizations that we generally compare ourselves to are the state of Washington, whose organization is probably the one most like ourselves, but they're a little bit larger than we are. Oregon, the state of Michigan, some of the New York funds. We're pretty fortunate in that we're kind of in the top third of those funds, but those are generally the ones that we're talking about. I'd say that we are one of the more productive ones. One measure that we look at is that amount of assets you've got relative to your investment staff. Most of our peers have one investment staff member for every $1 to $2 billion. On the one hand, feel pretty proud of our productivity. On the other hand, I think it's one of the biggest risks we've got. Rather than being in that $1 to $2 billion range, we're kind of in the $7 to $9 billion range. So that's one of the things that we are, thank you again last year for getting some modifications to our salary administration plan. We are in the midst of trying to plan our way to increase our staff. We have an investment staff of about 11 or 12 people out of a total staff of 24. And we've been trying to figure out what's the best approach to essentially double the staff. We're one of the few agencies that we focus on our investment staff primarily, but most of my investment staff doubles up and does a lot of the administrative efforts that most agencies have an administrative staff to do. We have an accounting staff, but I think that's one of the risks we've gotten, one of the things that we are in the process of trying to address.
Any further discussion or questions? If not, thank you very much, Director Perry.
I think I'm supposed to talk about one other item here. Yes, I'll be brief, and we don't have a lot of analysis that I plan on presenting with this. I think the study speaks for itself. What we're talking about is a study that I had one of our consultants do, Makita Investment Organization, is our special projects consultant, and when we back in 1917, when we did our last RFP for consultants, as part of our contract, I told them that I'd like them to review our portfolio for our exposures to climate risk and to give us some comparisons to, again, some of our sister organizations. So the study was done to provide me and the staff regarding kind of the management of our portfolio and any climate risk related aspects that would be within the portfolio. The intent was to determine if the actions that we were beginning to take with regards to our investment would have any mitigating impact on the risks within the portfolio. This was not a study to look at whether we should or should not divest, although the author was free to point out whether or not divestment was an action that we should or should not take to mitigate climate risk. The author explored our exposure and determined the companies that in our portfolio that were involved in the exploration and extraction of fossil fuels, and also companies in our portfolio that focused on renewable energy. Approximately 3% focused in exploration and extraction, and 2% in renewable. This is in line with the broad market that our passive managers cover for us. Passive managers don't report the factors that they consider. They just buy the entire market, and that's the vast bulk of how we manage our public equity portfolios. They essentially buy all the companies in our index. But while they aren't looking at them specifically for the factors they've got, we have two of the largest companies in the industry that manage our passive portfolios, BlackRock and State Street Global Advisors. Both of these organizations directly engage with managers on all facets of what they do, including environmental, social, and governance aspects. They're probably the most influential managers in the industry. Company CEOs would not dare to ignore their voice because when they vote the proxies that they're responsible for, they have the ability to have some not very small degree of influence on who management and the board of directors will be in the companies. And we directly benefit in that regard without having to directly be able to engage with all the companies in the index. The author of the study also explored if our fund managers were accounting for the climate risk, and with our active managers, a high degree of them do actively look at a lot of these factors that we're concerned about, primarily whether or not they're having impacts on climate risk, and if they're taking advantage of low-carbon investment opportunities in their investment process. Makita reviewed what we were doing relative to several of the U.S. Public pension funds that I previously mentioned, and they gave some recommendations to us that we should continue to, with regards to our due diligence and portfolio monitoring, that we should continue to regularly update our due diligence in each of our asset classes to ensure that material, physical, and energy transition climate risk and opportunities have been vetted, that we consider incorporating key indicators on climate risk exposure in performance reports, and that we consider periodically generating a climate risk report, including climate scenario analysis, consistent with the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. They also suggested with regards to our proxy voting and engagement that we continue to annually review our proxy voting guidelines for climate issues, continue participation in coordinated and institutional investor efforts, that we consider improving the consistency of proxy voting in our international equity portfolio. We currently vote our domestic proxies, and we allow them, our managers, to do the international. We are looking at also bringing that in-house. They suggest that we continue deepening the our engagement on climate risk with our investment managers, companies, and public policy regulators where feasible, and also with regards to our fiduciary responsibility that we become an active member in an organization called Climate Action 100+. With our investment allocations, that we be proactive and consider shifting a portion of the SBI assets to strategies that are expected to benefit from long-term shifts to a carbon, a low-carbon economy, and presuming that we do so with keeping with our fiduciary responsibility. Their final statement with regards to their recommendations was really a conclusion. They pointed out that, in their opinion, that divestment of fossil fuels does not impact the demand for non-renewable energy and therefore does not directly impact carbon emissions. If we were to do so, the SBI would be giving up its shareholder voting rights, and the and potentially this would transfer these rights to parties that don't share our investment beliefs and proxy voting policy, and that the risks of divestment from firms that may be actively transitioning to renewable energy might be foregone. So what are we doing? We have been, we think, spending a significant amount of time since I've returned to the state, our proxy voting. We vote our proxies pretty consistently. We've had some impact with regards to having some change. Much of it, again, we rely on the impact that our passive managers have. I think many of you might have seen some of the headlines from my friend Larry Fink last month, and the impact that he's had in getting people to focus on some of these areas that we've been spending our time on. We've been pretty active despite the small staff. I keep my lawyer counsel, John Millay, pretty active. We join a lot of coalitions and memberships. We're one of the founding members about 30 years ago, the Council of Institutional Investors, and they're mainly concerned with governance. Most of the efforts here relate to our being able to maintain our shareholders' rights and to oppose non-voting shares and keeping some transparency. We address, the CII address a lot of ESG considerations by making certain that investors receive fair and unbiased information from the companies we own. We're also a signatory in the United Nations Principle of Responsible Investment. We've been a member of that. The SBI has been a member of that for the last 2 years. I've been I was a signatory back in 2008 at another employer. These signatories focus on six principles related to integrating material ESG risk analysis into investment. As a member, we'll have to begin reporting in 2001 on our climate-related risks. We feel as though we're going in the right direction to be able to do that. We're also a member of Ceres Investor Network, the Institutional Limited Partners Association, Climate Action 100, the 30% Coalition, Midwest Investors Diversity Initiative, the RFK Compass Initiative. These are organizations that take those three words pretty seriously, that when we invest, that we're also cognizant of the impact that the companies that we own have in the environment, that there are good governance rights to ensure that we as owners are being kind of first in thought when companies are running their businesses. And also there are social aspects of these. I wouldn't say that we're a social investor, but there are a variety of factors that we look at, such that boards of management having a high degree of diversity. There's been significant research that's shown that the more diverse your employees are, the better performance and the better decisions that you get from management. So we've been pretty active. Unfortunately, we've got a small staff, and but we've been able to leverage what we do with the networking that both Howard and I have done with other CIOs around the country. So we believe that the Makeda study that we did didn't create many surprises to me. There have been many who have made comments that that weren't in favor of the study because it didn't have a conclusion that we should divest. I'm a strong believer that we remain pretty active in what we do and engaging with our companies. I believe that there has been movement towards ensuring that our companies will be, many of the companies that we own will be here for quite some time and profitable.
Thank you, Director Perry. Questions, comments? Gary. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Perry, as a part of the ongoing process and the assignment that you've undertaken here, I'm going to use a physics term. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. So I preface my comment with that by saying that in traditional energy sources where there are some concerns about carbon and different things versus what I'll call the new wave of energy, which there are less concerns about that, as a part of your due diligence process, are you looking at those traditional companies and seeing whether they are transitioning so that they don't go extinct from fossil fuels to other kinds of sources to be able to serve the population and to serve the economy? So that what someone might think, in other words, traditionally by a name of a company, behind the scenes they're actually making some transitions or changing company missions and changing company statements and how they're proceeding with energy development and delivery.
Mr. Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I believe that that's a primary reason why we engage. I believe that, we aren't denying the effects of fossil fuels, but there is a strong recognition that, primarily with the integrated oil companies, that given their size, that it's imperative that they are part of the transition from an old fossil fuel-based energy world to a renewable energy world. And we believe that the efforts that we're making have been, I wouldn't say facilitating, but have been pushing many of those companies in that fashion. I think it's imperative that we ensure that this transition takes place.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Perry, without putting words in your mouth, I thought I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that as energy needs and desires change, the companies are responding to that. And so what one might have thought 30 years ago or 20 years ago or even 15 or 10 years ago as a business model may have changed. And so you're watching those kinds of things to be able to make sure that the portfolio is managing risk as it relates to those, and the companies would being having a sufficient transition in order to be able to keep it in the portfolio to stay in existence if the modes of energy and things in the economy change.
Director Perry.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes. Many of the coalitions that we have joined, that's their primary objective, is to engage with the companies. And while I'd say that not all companies have been as receptive as we like, most of the integrated energy companies are making investments in renewable energy of various types, and they recognize the future. They recognize that for them to be sustainable and meaningful, that the world has changed, and they have to change with it in order to survive.
Senator Pappas. Senator Friend.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Perry. It's a good report, and this is a Pension Commission meeting, so we're not going to have an environment breakout, Environment Committee meeting, but I did want to note on page 10 it says an assumption that we're basing our analysis of the report on, next to what I think is a very helpful chart about greenhouse gas emissions since 1950. Most of the CO2 released since the 1800s by the United States and European countries remains in the atmosphere, contributing to the greenhouse effect responsible for climate change. So that's an assumption that they're making in this report as we talk about investment choices, right? And am I reading this correctly, Director Perry, that part of what the report says is while there may be challenges for companies who have their basis business operations in fossil fuels, there are also opportunities emerging in renewable energy and companies after we transition to a lower carbon economy?
Director Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. That's the way I look at it, and that's what we're trying to, in our coalitions, keep them pushing towards. Not all companies are jumping up and down and saying, I have to change tomorrow, but most companies are recognizing that. The difficulties are that, yeah, they are, it's not going to happen tomorrow. I think last year when I spoke, I pointed out that, some of the problems that exist are we're not ready for it. Most of us still drive combustible engine cars. Very few of us have solar panels on our houses. And we depend upon, unfortunately, still depend upon carbon-based energy. This is going to change. Unfortunately, it's not going to change tomorrow. I wish it could. And that's the big problem. A lot of it is our behavior, and unfortunately, some of these businesses are catering to our needs and want and behavior. But they are also going to be, they're energy companies for the most part. They're not fossil fuel companies. Type of energy that we use is changing. Not as fast as any of us want it to, but it is. A lot of the renewable research and development dollars are coming from these companies that, historically have only relied on fossil fuels. British Petroleum is probably the largest. Unfortunately, Exxon is probably the slowest, but they too are making large investments in renewable energy.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Perry, for commissioning the report. I think it's an important step forward and has a lot of good information. Unfortunately for me, I didn't realize this was on the agenda tonight, so I'm not prepared to make real extensive comments, but I am disappointed that it wasn't a little more aggressive approach to divestment, but we'll keep working on it.
Director Perry.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I understand that. We've noticed that there's legislation to do a study. This was commissioned under my meager budget 3 years before I even knew that there would be any bills. This cost me on the order of $50,000. The budget, fiscal note that went by my desk asking for a more comprehensive study. We really won't know what the cost of doing a more comprehensive study is, but the original estimates that we've heard from some of the people we've talked to are on the order of $500,000 to $1 million. The unfortunate things with studies like those is that by the time they're finished, they'll be stale. So I don't think I will be recommending that we use pension dollars to do a study of that ilk, but I would welcome someone doing the study and we'd cooperate with them.
Thank you. Senator Sinchum.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just have a question. About a week and a half ago, and you mentioned Larry Fink as a friend, actually. There was an article in the New York Times about this and about BlackRock, and it suggested he manages $7 trillion worth of assets. And his letter, if you will, to those that he writes letters to, which is a pretty notable group, I suspect, was suggesting, divestment, but certainly, he is suggesting, at least in that letter, that the investors, and he himself are going to be moving away from the fossil fuel kind of investments. I don't know, is that a large enough portfolio, so enough people kind of pick up on that it starts to affect, the whole market, so to speak. In other words, what kind of effect does somebody like that making that kind of a statement have on even our investment portfolio, potentially?
Director Perry.
Chairman Murphy, Senator Sinchum. Larry Fink is the chairman CEO of BlackRock. BlackRock is our largest investment manager. The statement that he made was his annual letter to CEOs of all the companies that I wouldn't say they own, but all the companies that they as manager invested on behalf of others. We get the benefit of Larry's statements, even though we're in what's called a separate account, and our dollars are invested along with $3 trillion. They're in the number that they speak up when they speak of BlackRock. They also have a lot of mutual funds and ETFs, which individuals like us own, and they get the vote all of the shares. So they have significant influence because of the amount of dollars that those shares represent and the number of shares within their mutual funds and so forth, as well as what we who have separate accounts would have. Larry got a lot of press for that. He's been very big on sustainability, and he has been pushing for people to recognize that, mostly CEOs, to recognize that they have to be serious about this when they run their companies. If they're not serious about it, he has enough influence with the number of shares under BlackRock's care to have influence on who the management of these companies are and who the board of directors are. So they will listen to what Larry says, and we benefit from that both directly and indirectly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the conclusions here seem focused kind of on the demand for non-renewable energy. Like it says, the divestment does not impact the demand for non-renewable energy. I guess I'm question that if enough pension funds consider something like divestment. But you know, I hear you saying that companies aren't moving to renewables as fast as we'd like. So it seems like there's kind of a supply issue as well. I'm just wondering if the report looked at the impact of divestment on companies' supply goals. I'm wondering really if divestment, you know, especially if a lot of pension funds move that direction, would speed up the company's transition to renewables, which certainly seems like a worthy goal for me.
Director Perry.
Chairman Murphy, Representative. Part of the problem is the speed of technology. When we invest in renewables, it's usually with organizations that are putting our money not in research and development, but in proven technologies. Several of our private market managers, we've invested in their renewable energy funds, two of which BlackRock manages for us. The big difficulty with some of these things are the technologies not coming along as fast as we'd like, although there is a lot of research going by it. One of the difficulties, we've got electric cars. Believe that there's going to be significant demand for electric cars, but if the fleet of cars today, or at least this is the number I had last year, if 10% of the fleet of cars in the U.S. today were electric and they were plugged in, we would essentially break the grid. We don't have enough, battery power for cars. Well, batteries go maybe 200-300 miles. They're still expensive. Most of us are still relying on carbon combustible engines, and until our behavior change and the technology changes, that probably retards the speed of what's taking place. But I do believe that we will see more renewables. There are more companies that are putting dollars into this. Unfortunately, when we make investments, I don't have the luxury of taking pension dollars and explore. We usually have to give our, and this is, and for the most part, when we invest through managers. Right now, 75%+ are through stock and bond managers who invest in companies. The money that we give them buy shares in companies that already exist. It's not new money going in, and it's really not going to the company. These dollars are essentially, I buy something, I'm buying stock one day, you're selling that stock, we're just trading who owns it. Not any new money is going to a company because of that. In the private markets, there's a little bit more new money, primarily in venture capital, which we're too big to be in. But that's why we engage with the companies and push them for the development, because we have ownership in it, but we're not injecting new dollars into these ourselves.
Thank you, Director Perry. We have received the climate risk investment study that you commissioned, and we will continue to peruse it, and there may be questions at a later time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is number 6. House File 3903, Representative Murphy, Senator Rosen, the State Retirement System. Ms. Leonard, would you like to present the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Leonard. I am the Executive Director of MSRS. And House File 3903, Senate File 3808, is the MSRS Administrative Bill. I'm going to go through it section by section, so if you have any questions, just stop me, and I'm happy to answer them. Sections 1, 10, and 15 clarify the definition of dependent child for survivor benefits in the General Employees Retirement Plan. When an individual is an active employee and they pass away while active, their surviving spouse and or dependent children receive a benefit that they might have earned later in their retirement. This adds a cross-reference to the referencing the Minnesota Uniform Probate Code section that defines the child as only a dependent if it was in gestation prior to the member's death. So this just clarifies that dependent child definition. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 codify our existing practice of returning excess employer contributions to an employer as a credit against future contributions. So current statute is silent on this, on how we treat excess employer contributions. This proposed language aligns with both our longstanding administrative practice as well as the statutes of the other retirement systems, so it adds some consistency. Sections 6, 9, and 12 codify the existing administrative requirements for disability benefit applications. So currently an individual has to submit, when they apply for disability, they have to submit an application that they complete, two physician statements, and an employer certification. This just clarifies that all of those documents must be submitted to us prior to the statutory deadline of 18 months after termination of service in order to be considered a complete application packet. Section 7 adds podiatrists to the list of non-physician medical practitioners who can submit reports as evidence to support an application for disability. So current law allows psychologists, chiropractors, physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners to complete that physician statement for the disability application packet. This would add podiatrists to that list. One of the two physician statements must be completed by a medical doctor. So this just expands it to include podiatrists. Sections 8 and 18 repeal the sections permitting members to purchase forfeited service credit in third payments. So in the past, members could complete, if they took a refund of service or and they wanted to purchase that time, they could make that purchase in three payments. We are repealing this. That section specifically was predated the federal legislation, which we commonly call EGTRA, the Economic Growth and Tax Reconciliation Reform Act of 2001. That EGTRA Act actually permits members to complete that purchase using other retirement plan assets. And in the case of MSRS, 87% of our purchases of service actually come from the deferred compensation plan or other retirement assets to make the purchase. So we'd like to just make those in one chunk rather than three payments. Section 11 removes obsolete language from the state patrol plan. It's actually a position that is no longer in existence from back in the 1980s. Sections 13 and 14 actually rewrite the list of supplemental retirement plans that public employees may participate in. This is the defined contribution plans where employer dollars can be contributed for matching dollars, including our deferred compensation plan. The old language included some language that specifically was called wholly and solely funded by the employee's accumulated sick leave, vacation, and severance. So this allows individuals who receive a severance pay on their unused sick or vacation at the time of separation to defer part of that severance to a a plan in this list. And this wholly and solely language was being interpreted differently depending on the providers that were reviewing it. Some third-party administrators were interpreting this to mean it had to be a separately funded plan, which added to the cost for both the participants and the administrators. So we just wanted to remove this wholly and solely funded language so that these severance contributions can go into their existing supplemental retirement plan that they have in place. The other provision that was changed in this section at the request or at the recommendation of the LCPR staff was to require individuals or plans sponsors who have who are included in this population to submit an annual report of investment return to the LCPR for posting, and they can elaborate a little bit more on that one. Section 16 updates the process used to transmit supplemental state appropriations to the judges' fund. So the judges receive an annual appropriation. This appropriation, actually, the way that it works goes directly to the judges' fund rather than through MMB, and we just wanted to clarify the process and statute to be consistent with how it's actually working. And then Section 17 reinstates a benefit multiplier for the judges' plan that was accidentally deleted and removed in error in some of the, in I think last year's legislation or the prior year. So this is for the Tier 2 judges' benefit. They have two multipliers depending on when they started as a judge, and we just need that multiplier back into the statute.
Anything to add, Mr. Burkett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple comments. The first is deals with that sections 13 and 14, the where we moved the deferred compensation definition. As Ms. Leonard pointed out, we did suggest to Ms. Leonard that they add some language that requires deferred compensation plan providers to submit their fee disclosure forms to the LCPR. So those forms would be submitted to us. The current statute says they have to disclose those forms, but doesn't say who they're disclosed to. It doesn't even say whether it's to the member or not. So we just cleaned up some of that language, and then there is a new requirement, which is that they file it with the LCPR. So I wanted to highlight that for the commission. And then one other comment, which is just to add on about the payment in three parts, and just highlight again that this actually applies to all four of the big retirement plans, so MSRS, TRA, PARA, and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association will all be affected by that change.
Questions, comments? If not, I move that House File 3903 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 omnibus bill. Anyone from the audience wish to testify? If not, I renew my motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Ms. Leonard.
Thank you.
Number 7, Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, thank you. So I know I was told that I didn't have to be here, but when the plans came to me, I was so jazzed up. I said, I really want to be there to present with all of you. And so I just wanted to do a quick intro to this bill, and they're the experts, and we'll have them go through the details of it. But I just want to say that, Madam Chair and committee, commission members, is that right? Commission members? House File 3752 is the Teachers Retirement Association, or TRA's, 2020 administrative bill. This bill is intended to be a technical bill with no substantive impact on members. The revision in the bill include deleting obsolete language in several definitions, clarifying language in provisions relating to annuity accrual dates, calculating refund interest, and military service credit purchases, correcting an error in the early retirement reduction provision to bring the language into conformity with current practice, and also includes a retroactive effective date. repealing an unused provision that allows a member to prospectively reduce their benefit and making other technical corrections. And so with that as a quick summary, I'm going to turn it over to the individuals here who can walk through the bill itself.
Ms. Barr, Mr. Stoffel, welcome.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay Stoffel. I'm the Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. And I will not spend a whole lot of time saying much. I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Barth to go through the nine sections of the bill.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Barth. I'm the Legal and Legislative Director with the Teachers Retirement Association. Thank you for that great intro, Representative Herr. So I'll just go through each section, and if you have questions, please just feel free to stop me. So sections one and two deal with updating definitions. Section one, we're removing language talking about people working in a charitable, penal, or correctional institution of the government. A charitable institution I found is an orphanage, which does not exist anymore. And then anybody working in penal or correctional institutions would now be covered by PARA or MSRS, so we don't have any active members in correctional institutes, so we're just removing that whole section. Section two deals with our definition of annual-based salary. So that is how we calculate service credit based on the lowest salary of a full-time teacher. And in the charter school provision of that definition, it says full-time licensed teacher, and licensure has nothing to do with how we determine salary. So we're just removing that word because it causes some confusion with our employers. Section three just removes redundant language pertaining to our retirement accrual date options. Pretty simple. Section four deletes obsolete language that is sunsetted, and then it also corrects an error that was discovered back in 2018 with the omnibus pension bill, but at the time that it was discovered, the bill was already moving through the committee process, so it was just decided that Terry could come forward later and correct that error via an admin bill, because it was understood that we would still be administering our early retirement reduction factors in the same way. So right now, and actually, I'll back up. In 2013, TRA implemented this provision where we reduce benefits based on a person's age, and there are specific set factors, so percentages, based on that person's age. And the bend point is age 59, where it switches from 4% to 7%. And for some reason, in 2018, just something was lost in translation, and that age was put in as age 60. But we have never administered it that way, so we're just trying to now correct it to say age 59. So again, it's something that was identified. We have not administered it any differently. And so now we're just cleaning it up, which is why you'll also see retroactive effective dates, just to, again, make sure that it's really clear that the intent was to always have that bend point be age 59 and not 60. Section four just corrects an erroneous statutory reference that doesn't actually exist anymore. Section six clarifies the time frame for how we calculate a refund. And again, this is just making the language more consistent with how we administer and calculate that refund interest, just to make it less ambiguous or cause any problems in the future. Section seven deals with prior military service credit purchases. So our members, if they served in the military prior to becoming teachers, they can purchase that service. But if that military service was performed prior to July 1, 1989, but they were not teachers prior to that date, they are not eligible for the Rule of 90. So we're just making that very clear in this provision, just to assuage any future confusion with that. Section 8 is another retroactive effective date dealing with the bend point issues of our early retirement reduction. And again, that's just to point back that the language in 2013 always intended that bend point to be at age 59, not 60. So again, just supporting the intent of that provision. And then section 9 repeals an option that members have. It was put into the statute in the 50s and has never actually been utilized, but it allows a member who's receiving a benefit to prospectively and permanently reduce their benefit. We could not come up with a good policy reason for why we would allow something like that to happen. So we're just deleting it and repealing that section. So that's our 2020 admin bill. Anybody has any questions?
Any questions? Mr. Burkett, any additions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Ms. Barth did a good job going over the change in section four that relates to the bend point. I'll just confirm again that the change in the language is substantive, but it's not a substantive change in practice for TRA.
Okay, Representative Herr, motion. Representative Herr moves the House File 3752 be recommended to pass and be incorporated into the 2020 Omnibus Pension Bill. Any further discussion? Anyone from the audience? If not, Representative Herr renews her motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Going on to number 8, Representative Herr again. And with her is Representative Herr is Ms. Hennessy Allen. So Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before you announce House File 3777, I don't know the actual motion that I'm supposed to make for this particular one. If you could help me out a little bit. Am I making a motion to move this? Or should I just describe the
Representative Herr moves adoption of 3777, Senate Files 3672 be recommended to pass and be incorporated in the 2020 Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is the motion. Thank you. I had the sheet with me, too. So before you is House File 3777, Madam Chair and Committee. With this bill, again, very similar to the other one, is making technical changes. State Auditor Blaha was going to be here today to provide details around this particular bill, but she, unfortunately, is ill. So I'm just going to go over quickly about what this is, and then I'll turn this over to the testifier here, who is the expert on this. But the Office of the State Auditor staff proposed changes to the investment disclosure reporting requirements for the State Board of Investment, a University of Minnesota U of M faculty supplemental plan, and local public pension plan with at least $50 million in assets. What I maybe want to do is talk about the specifics of this bill, eliminates the annual investment reporting for the SBI and U of M plan and eliminates the separate investment reporting for the Bloomington and St. Paul teachers plan, so long as the OSA performs the annual financial audit and reviews the investment information as part of the audit. The bill also cleans up language in the investment reporting section for Volunteer Fire Relief Association, but makes no other substantive changes. And I will turn it over to the testifier here, who will talk about why the history, maybe current situation as to why the bill is needed now.
Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Hello, my name is Rose Hennessy Allen. I'm the pension director at the Office of the State Auditor. So the investment reporting statute was originally enacted in 1994, and back at that time there were 20 large local public pension plans in existence, and they were required to report to our office and required to report on a calendar year rather than the plan fiscal year, so that we could calculate and provide rates of return and provide you with an apples-to-apples comparison for those plans. And then in addition, the SBI was required to report to us as kind of a benchmark to compare those plans against. Now there's only two plans left that have over local plans with over $50 million in assets. It's the Bloomington Fire Department Relief Association and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. And our office performs the annual financial audit for both of those plans. And so we already are receiving and reviewing detailed investment information for both of those entities as part of the audit work. And so it's a duplicative reporting to also have them report this investment information separately to our pension division. The bill also eliminates the investment reporting for the SBI and for the U of M faculty plan. Those two entities provide pretty limited investment information to us that's already publicly available online. And so it was, again, duplicative reporting for those two groups. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Lentowski, do you have anything to add?
I have nothing, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Representative Herr.
So I renew my motion to move House File 3777, be recommended to pass, and be incorporated into the 2020 Omnibus Pension Bill.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Last on the agenda. Is House File 3788 and 3789. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'll move the House File 3788 first to be recommended to pass and be incorporated in the 2020 Omnibus Pension Bill. And Madam Chair, there's some testifiers if they want to come down to the table. But Madam Chair, last year, a year before, we found out there was a St. Paul schools and the city of St. Paul were mistakenly paying into funds that they weren't authorized to pay into, and that was discovered. And last year, we in the pension bill, we gave them a year's extension to do that. But then we, in the interim, they came up and they met and they came with a fix for the mistake that was made. And House File 3788 is the retroactive for the stuff that was going passed in the that basically authorizes them to make those payments that they made already. And so, Madam Chair, I'll let the testifiers answer questions or testify if they need to. But basically, it is they met over the summer. They came up with a fix with the Pension Commission of the mistake that was made, and this bill 3788 incorporates that fix.
Okay, on 3788.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Colin Beery. I am the political director for the Sheet Metal Workers Local 10. First off, I would like to say thank you for last session, the session law that was passed. It was well needed for us to acquire the hard work and effort that we put in over the interim, which was a lot of time and effort. Also, would like to thank the LCPR staff, Susan, Chad, Lisa, they were tremendous, so thank you very much for that. So the bill, essentially, Nelson had expressed, Representative Nelson had expressed, is after we passed the session law, we formated by five, six large group meetings with all the parties invested in this, the building trades invested, the LCPR, the City of St. Paul, the City of St. Paul School District, PARA, the cities and counties, a large group, anywhere from 20 to 30 individuals in the room per meeting, and then probably a handful or better of some smaller group coordination throughout the midterm, interim. And this is the product that we have come up with here. It's essentially a grandfathered status for our members that either work and are employed by the City of St. Paul, the City of St. Paul School District, that the members that are there currently will be grandfathered in. Their packages will stay the same, essentially. They will stay in PARA. And then effective July 2020, they will no longer any new employment contribute to PARA. They will contribute 100% to the outside package negotiated by the collective bargaining agreements per union. So I'd like to say that the building trades that you see on the paper, on the bill, are in general support of this bill. And then also, to my right is Brendan Cummings. He is a labor counsel for a vast majority of the building trades in this bill. He's here for any technical support if we need to take that deep dive. So if you have those questions, I would appreciate it if you would allow me to defer to Brendan on those. I'll turn it over to the City of St. Paul School District and the City of St. Paul to introduce themselves, and if you don't have any questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Beery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Please. Chair, I'm Jim Vollmer. I'm the Assistant Director of Employee and Labor Relations for St. Paul Public Schools.
Madam Chair, my name is Jason Schmidt. I am the Labor Relations Manager for the City of St. Paul.
Jason Schmidt. Any further comments, Mr. Fulmer?
Madam Chair, I would just like to support what Mr. Beery has stated here today. This was a very good effort between the parties, very congenial, and the parties worked very hard during the interim here to come together and provide the legislation that's here in front of you today.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand what's going on here, but my basic question is, so what happens to the money that's already been contributed to PARA on behalf of the employee from the employer and the employee? What happens to those contributions?
I will defer to Brennan.
Okay.
The contributions stay in PARA. Thank you, Madam Chair. The contributions stay in PARA. Nothing happens. Mr. Beery was explaining is that employees who are currently in PARA and also in a multi-employer plan, outside pension plan, are grandfathered in and stay in both.
In both, okay.
So they will continue. And that was one of our main objectives, was to keep everyone whole who's currently employed and currently in those retirement plans, but just to go on a different path going forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Lencheski, do you have anything to add?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The memo goes into a number of kind of nuances about all this. One of them is that this statute 356.24 was put into the statutes back in 1971, and there is subdivision 1 and subdivision 2. Subdivision 2 actually requires every time there's a change in benefits or employer contributions in these supplemental plans, it is required to the employer that's making these changes is required to come in and get legislative approval mm-hmm. of that change. The number of plans that are supplemental plans in the state is huge. Mm. As far as we can tell, every school district has a 403B arrangement. There's a lot of these multi-employer plans, as we're talking about. There's a number of 457B plans, another type of plan that cities are setting up. So as far as we know, Subdivision 2 has never been complied with. So the fact that there's some non-compliance with Subdivision 1 is not all that surprising. Mm-hmm. So part of the bill, or one of the provisions in the bill, repeals Subdivision 2. Mm-hmm. So we no longer are going to be requiring plans to come in and request approval for changes. So the other thing, too, I wanted to mention is that in as we worked on this, we checked in with the city of Minneapolis to see what their situation was, to see if they had a similar problem. We found that they were making contributions to multi-employer plans, but they were staying within the limits in the statutes. Mm-hmm. So right now there's 4 supplemental plans that are multi-employer plans. You can contribute to those up to $5,000 or $7,000 per employee per year. And Minneapolis is making those contributions, but they are staying within the limits. We also found, with the help of the League and the County Association, that cities and counties, too, are entering into collective bargaining agreements that require these contributions. Mainly, we found to the operating engineers' pension plan. But again, in those cases, they were also staying within the limit as far as we could tell. The survey was very informal, so we can't say for sure that there is or is not, you know, complete compliance, but it does look like their understanding what the statute says, and they in fact are even working it into the language of their contract. Mm-hmm. One thing that we ran into in this survey was that a number of the employers thought that these contributions were employee contributions going into these multi-employer plans, which is not the case. These plans aren't able to accept employee contributions, so whether there's any intentional misleading or not, we can't tell, but certainly we were trying to understand how it is that a number of the employers who are negotiating these agreements thought, in fact, that these were employee contributions, so not subject, perhaps, to this restriction. So a little bit of work, I think, needs to be done in terms of communicating that requirement. The other thing we found was that there, the $5,000 limit in the statute is, there's some interest in increasing that limit. So we did hear, and I believe there's a testifier here who may want to talk about this, but the three that are affected by the $5,000 limit are the operating engineers, the machinists, and the pipe trades. They may be looking at an increase in that limit, and we can then look at that over the interim. There is some opposition to that, however. The league, in surveying their some of their employers, did hear from some of them that they were not interested in increasing the limit because of the potential pressure on the bargaining process and having to make more contributions. So those are some of the other, I think, remaining issues. We also believe there are some public employers that are making these contributions to plans that are not listed in the statute. So right now, the bills that we have in front of us are only addressing St. Paul City and St. Paul School District. There are some others that are in a similar situation, either exceeding the limits or making contributions to multi-employer plans that aren't covered. So there's we turned over a few of these stones or rocks, found some things there that probably need to be fixed through the interim. We can look at those, but this is a statute that has not really been communicated to many of these employers. So I think this kind of, knowledge now that many of us have, I think is going to get out there, and the league and the county associations will, I think, help with that. So I guess those are my comments. Again, if there's questions, the testifiers can help, or I may be able to help.
Any comments, or Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions. So if there are others out there that aren't known yet, are we setting a precedent that basically brings everybody in so we'd had kind of an unknown approval of plans that are out there, because it would be pretty hard to tell them they can't if indeed we've said these can.
Ms. Lanchesky.
Chair, Representative Vogel, so the bills don't allow anybody else to do it, so it's just these two employers. We now kind of know some of these, so the people involved in the group have been pretty forthcoming about the ones that are not complying. So I think what we probably want to do is go back and check in with them. But non-compliance with this section, the statute, is something we don't have any enforcement mechanism. The legislative auditor is not looking at this. We're not cops. We're not out checking with every employer to see if they're complying. So we don't really have a mechanism to determine whether there is compliance. We did get some information, though, through the course of the work groups meetings, that there are some of these out there, and so we will go back, contact them during the interim, and see if they want to propose something similar, or where we go with those employers.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and it does beg the question, should we be doing this individually or holistically, because we are setting a precedent, and if we find out that there's more out there, we could be. I remember this, and I'm not necessarily against it, but I hate to see partial solutions where we do something, and then later we have to do other things that kind of stay consistent with it. So I don't want to necessarily hold this up tonight, but I think if we're going to do this tonight, we should be prepared before this omnibus bill goes to make sure that we've got everything, or that at least we're knowledgeable, because if we pass a bill and it's just doing this, and then all of a sudden we find out there's 50 others out there, going to be pretty tough to say no.
But not in the capital city.
Oh. The other thing, Madam Chair, is I looked at this sheet with the numbers on it, and it seems to be kind of a, what I would say, a qualified opinion relative to the accuracy. I guess my question would be, is there a significance that we should be attaching to this, or is it just kind of something that's thrown in there that's nice to have and we really don't have to pay a lot of attention to it?
I don't know. Mine is here. It wasn't part of my packet, so I don't know where this came from.
It wasn't prepared.
Oh, okay. came from the usual sources. Okay. Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Vogel. So this came together kind of today in trying to pull together data from a lot of different sources. So one of the great things about the bills is that it requires reporting to us so we can try to figure out what's going on here, like exactly which plans are receiving contributions. I think the thing that we found interesting was, frankly, the size of the contributions per employee per year, which we felt was important for the commission to see, as well as the funded status of some of the plans to which these contributions are being made. So these are multi-employer plans, like Central States, which we've all heard about, which is about to cut benefits for their retirees. I don't think any of these are anywhere near that situation, but it is a monitoring job, I think, going forward. So as we get the reporting from the city and the school district, we will be able to put this chart together every year for the commission and sort of watch what's going on here, because these are public funds going into these plans, and we were not aware, and there was no way really for us to be aware. So that's the point of the chart, and I'm sorry for the big disclaimer. It was partly my frustration with not being able to really nail down, you know, this the details of this chart.
Madam Chair.
Representative Vogel.
I appreciate this. And I guess I'm not going to suggest that we hold this up tonight if it's the right thing to do, but I really do have a lot. There are some loose ends here, and I'm not sure where we go from here that we fix this before the omnibus bill is drafted, because these are things that are going to matter going forward. And I don't want to mess things up tonight for motions that are already in order, but I do have somewhat of a discomfort level with us going into these things with uncertainties, because we don't know how deep that hole could be relative to things we have to go back and fix up again.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. These are multi-employer plans that are backed by ERISA, and they do reporting every year, and now we're going to be getting that reports here. I'm in one of these plans, and I see those reports every year. Part of the confusion is as to why these are some people consider employee contributions is because the building trades as a whole negotiate with their employers, they negotiate on the total package, and then they vote how much money out of what raise they might get goes into their pension, into the different funds, into the health care funds and that, and they make these determinations every year. Technically, IRS rules, when they make those, decide to put a quarter this year into the pension or a quarter to health and welfare, those are no longer employee deductions but or employee contributions, but they can't become by IRS standards an employer deduction. But a lot of our members that are in these plans that are paying into them still think of those as something that comes off my check. It's my contribution, when technically, because of IRS rules, they become employer deductions. And I think that's some of the confusion there. But these are ERISA-backed plans, all of them, and they have trustees and they have board of trustees that overlook them and make recommendations every year that this is what we need to do to make this plan whole or to keep it moving on the right course to becoming whole. And just like our pension plans that we as the state oversee, they got hit. A lot of these plans were fully vested or almost fully vested before the crash in 2008 and or the Great Recession, I guess they're calling it. But and they got hit, and they're digging themselves out, just like the state's digging themselves out of some of those losses that they had during those times.
Senator France.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your concern, Representative Vogel, and I think we have some of those details hanging out there, but I'd encourage us to pass this tonight, recognizing one other factor, which is that we are in a position to tell a group that did reach an agreement, good job, and set a standard where other groups in the future may find, hey, look how well it went for them when they sat down and worked it out, and hopefully create an environment where the other groups out there may find that that's a better path than fighting about it. So I'd say we pass it tonight.
Any further discussion? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? If not, Representative Nelson renews his motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll move House File 3789 to be recommended to pass and be incorporated in the 2020 Omnibus Pension Bill. And Madam Chair, this is coming out of the same work group and the same thing. This is going forward that to make the changes necessary to allow this to go forward in the past, where the previous bill was fixing the grandfathered status of that. One provision in here that new employees, when they're hired from the building trades, would be no longer be in para going forward. The new employees that are hired would just be in the, what a lot of times called the outside plans, the local union plans that they're involved in with their local unions. But the current employees that are in para would continue making their payments into para for those employees.
Do you have any other comments to make? Okay. Ms. Lucchesi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only comment would be that it is in this bill where the repeal of Subdivision 2 appears. So that was the one I mentioned, the approval of benefit changes would go away.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Nelson renews his motion for House File 3789. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Maybe we'll have to have
a good job on
former Representative Vogel monitoring this in the future.
Madam Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair, could I just have 1 second to thank Senator Senjum for carrying the companion on the Senate side?
He's wonderful, isn't
yes.
he?
Thank you.
It was a gallant effort.
Yes, it certainly was. If not, if there's no other business to come before us tonight. Oh, Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Chair. For a minute, unofficially represent the twice exceptional print disabled. Thank you that I can come and testify at the Legislation and Pension and Retirement. This is a follow-up on digital accessibility. I will provide you a handout as well as Mr. Limmer today regarding the digital accessibility, regarding your documents and your web pages. Hopefully you will address this in the future. Mr. Nelson here passed 1962 bill for digital accessibility. However, they defunded the bill and moved the working group in out recommendations for 2 years. Last but least, because this is not captioned with video, this is only audio, so it's not fully accessible based on ADA. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Any questions? We accept your testimony.
I ask that the record would reflect that I had a handout as well. Thank you for this opportunity for retaining records as well for the future.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.